Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Comment ma fille et moi pouvons-nous définir qui peut lui envoyer des messages? Comment parler avec mon fils des bons comportements à adopter en ligne? Si vous avez des questions sur la sécurité de vos ados en ligne, vous trouverez des ressources utiles dans le Centre Familial Instagram. Le Centre Familial vous permet de paramétrer la supervision parentale avec votre ado. Et dans l'espace éducation, vous trouverez des conseils d'experts pour discuter de sécurité. Découvrez nos outils pour la famille sur instagram.com/outils-pour-la-famille.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Monday, the 27th of November, these are our main stories. Joe Biden welcomes the release of another 17 people kidnapped and held in Gaza, including a four-year-old girl orphaned in the Hamas attack on southern Israel.
The proof that this is working and worth pursuing further is in every smile and every grateful tear we see on the faces of those families who are finally getting back together again.
In return, Israel frees 39 Palestinian prisoners on the third day of a pause in fighting between Israel and Hamas. And Sierra Leone says most of the presumed leaders of a day of military unrest in the capital have been arrested. Also in this podcast, an ethnic militia seizes control of another border crossing in northern Myanmar. And
it doesn't matter which player you speak to that's played for Terry, all of them would speak incredibly highly of them, not just as a coach, but also as a human being and a lovely, lovely, fun man.
We look back at the life of the former England football manager Terry Venables, who has died at the age of 80. The past 3 days of the pause in fighting in Gaza has seen a mounting number of Israeli and Thai hostages freed and Palestinian prisoners released. And after 6 weeks of war, people in Gaza are receiving more supplies of desperately needed aid. So for Israelis and Palestinians, their hopes have been raised. But the four-day pause is due to end on Monday after 50 hostages are released and 150 prisoners freed. The agreement, brokered by Qatar, could see Israel and Hamas extend this for several more days, something President Biden is pushing for.
This deal is delivering life-saving results. Critically needed aid is going in and hostages are coming out. And this deal is structured so that it can be extended. To keep building on these results, that's our goal, to keep this pause going beyond tomorrow so that we can continue to see more hostages come out and surge more humanitarian relief into those who are in need in Gaza. But the proof that this is working and worth pursuing further is in every smile and every grateful tear we see on the faces of those families who are finally getting back together again. The proof is little Abigail.
Abigail Edan is one of the first American hostages to be released. She has Israeli dual citizenship and lost her parents when they were killed by Hamas on October the 7th and turned four while she was in captivity. Abigail was freed along with 13 other Israelis and three Thai nationals. And as part of the deal, 39 Palestinians held by Israel were also freed. Meanwhile, the UN has said that 61 lorries with aid were delivered to northern Gaza, which has seen the fiercest fighting. It's the largest number so far. But even in the south of the Palestinian territory, people such as Ula al-Kashash are still struggling to find enough to eat.
We are being humiliated. Everything was bombed. We have to stand in a queue for 10 hours sometimes, only to come back late at night with a small piece of bread. We can't afford anything. The situation is very dire. There is nothing more to say.
The Hamas-controlled health authority says that 15,000 people have been killed in Gaza, a third of them children. The war started after Hamas massacred more than 1,200 people in southern Israel and abducted, according to Israel, around 240 others. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Lucy Williamson, gave me an update on the latest group to be freed.
both the hostages freed by Hamas and 39 Palestinian prisoners freed from Israeli jails. That exchange has taken place. They are thought to, all of those Palestinian prisoners, be 18 years or under. One of them, we think, is 14 years under house arrest. That house arrest now been removed. It does seem as if day three of this truce has gone a little bit more according to plan than yesterday, when we saw those very long delays, high anxiety around whether the agreement was breaking down.
We heard from President Biden. He's keen to see the pause in the fighting extended. What are the chances of Israel agreeing to this?
Well, I think this is where the attention is focused increasingly day by day as we get to the end of this four-day truce. The question of what happens on the day after is looming larger. Israel has always said it's going to resume the war after this temporary ceasefire. But tonight we heard from President Biden, they're calling for the ceasefire to be extended. And in fact, we've got news that Hamas has also signaled to negotiators that it's ready to extend the truce by 2 to 4 days. I mean, that they say would mean potentially another 20 to 40 Israeli hostages being released if that were agreed, because the terms of the agreement outlined earlier were that Israel would offer another day of truce for every 10 hostages released beyond this current deal. At the moment, so far from Israel, we've heard more reiteration that it's going to resume the war once this truce ends. But of course, we still do have more than 24 hours to run, and the intervention of President Biden is significant.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was in Gaza for the first time since the start of the war today. Let's just listen to what he said to soldiers.
We are here in the Gaza Strip with our heroic fighters. We are making every effort to return our hostages. And at the end of the day, we will return everyone. We have three goals in this war. Eliminate Hamas, return of all our hostages, and ensure that Gaza does not return to be a threat to the state of Israel again. We are continuing until the end, until victory. Nothing will stop us.
Lucy, as you can hear, Mr. Netanyahu sounding defiant. Is there a danger for him if the pause goes on that this could end up into a full ceasefire?
I think he's always been very clear that that is not what he wants, that the 7th of October attacks changed something for Israel, and that they're no longer mowing the grass, as they used to say. They're no longer doing just enough to keep what they perceive as the threat under control. Now it's a different goal. He wants to destroy Hamas, destroy their ability to threaten Israel militarily, but also politically. And he's put that front and center of those three war aims that you heard there. Even when it comes to returning the hostages, which has become a more prominent part of those war aims over the last few weeks, that goal of destroying Hamas has always been front and center. And don't forget, I mean, Israel's politicians and its military have a lot to prove after the intelligence failures and the security failures of the 7th of October.
Lucy Williamson in Jerusalem. To West Africa now. Gunshots shattered the early morning calm on the streets of Sierra Leone's capital, Freetown, as rebel soldiers attempted to break into a military armory. Several jails were also attacked. Sporadic gunfire continued into the afternoon, though the authorities insist they've regained control of most of the city. This was the country's information minister, Chernor Ba, talking to the BBC on Sunday.
We have declared a nationwide curfew. We're asking our residents to stay indoors, especially because we're in the process of trying to track down the retreating renegades who attempted this illegal activity.
The president, Julius Maada Bio, has said most of the presumed leaders of an attack on the barracks in the capital, Freetown, have been arrested. So, has calm been restored? I heard more from our correspondent in Freetown, Umaru Fofana.
Yes, I've just taken a long stroll down the main road in my neighbourhood, and people are generally staying indoors. It's the longest hiatus of quiet since dawn today.
Are we any clearer on precisely what happened today? Because the trouble was almost everywhere, wasn't it?
It was almost everywhere in the capital city and its outskirts. In the provinces, we're told that it was all quite quiet. In Freetown, it all started at a military barracks called Wilberforce, which is literally walking distance from the president's residence. Some soldiers broke into the armory. The shooting continued elsewhere by the same attackers who were in various parts of the capital, and then they went to the eastern outskirts, and there was heavy shooting in a place called Jue, which has an armed police barracks. And then the internal affairs minister told me that they also attacked a police barracks where he said that he seized arms and ammunition.
And attacks on prisons, in at least one case, prisoners being freed.
At least in the country's two main prison facilities. The attackers went there and then they set free all the prisoners, thousands of them. And then they went to the female prison and released all the female prisoners. I saw at least two sets of prisoners working with, in handcuffs. And they were roaming all over the place. And that was exactly what made a lot of people wake up to take seriously the whole of today's development.
What is the speculation as to who was behind this?
It's not clear at all. All we know is some soldiers went into this military barracks and then seized the armory. I'm told that at least a dozen others were by the president's lodge, apparently waiting for signal from their colleagues from the barracks. And then some presidential guards got wind of it and they came down and more or less warded off that apparent attack that was building towards the president's lodge.
So it sounds like a coup was at least a possibility, an attempted coup.
It does sound like that. Otherwise, why would soldiers go to the country's main military barracks and seize its armory just to get arms and ammunition and get out of the place looking so well armed? And why would they want to attack the president's lodge? The government is not actually clearly saying that. They are referring to them as bandits and as rogue elements. It bears the hallmarks of an attempted military coup. And I've got to say that it may be quiet right now, but nobody is certain. Probably beneath the veneer of quietness belies some untoward intent. We don't know. So there is real angst here across Freetown, even if people are trying to not allow themselves to think about something which is more serious than witnessed today.
Umaru Fofana in Freetown. Rescue efforts are at a standstill once again at the site of a tunnel collapse in the northern Indian state of Uttarakhand, where 41 construction workers have been trapped for 2 weeks. As we reported in our previous podcast, rescuers have been unable to get them out after a drilling machine broke down. A new specialised piece of equipment called a superheated plasma cutter was sent by the Indian Air Force on Sunday, but that too has failed. BBC's South Asia correspondent Samira Hussain sent this report on the latest setback in attempts to get the workers out.
About 100 metres away from me is the mouth of the tunnel. You can hear the whirring of machines. That's where all the activity is happening. This is the primary way that emergency workers are trying to get to the men that are trapped inside the tunnel. That's the voice of the rescue workers speaking to the trapped men. For 2 weeks, they've been cut off from the outside world, getting food and water from a small pipe. For days, crews here have been using this massive drilling machine to break through the rubble. And they got through almost about 50 meters of debris within just a few days. But now the machine keeps breaking down, because what makes this rescue operation so complicated is that they're not only dealing with debris, but they're also dealing with construction materials and pieces of metal. And that's what the drill keeps getting caught on. Chaudhary son Manjeet is stuck in the tunnel. He traveled from his village to be here for when he gets out. His eldest son died in a construction accident 2 years ago, and he cannot face that grief again.
I pray to God that please don't take this son away from me. All I want is that my son should be out. This is my prayer. This is my last wish.
It's been almost 2 weeks since the accident, and the men are still not out.
Can I ask you a question from BBC News?
I asked Bhaskar Kulbe about that. He's the former advisor to the Prime Minister and is overseeing the rescue.
Why has it taken so long? We're on day 12.
That analysis could take time.
So it's about 7 o'clock in the morning. We've been here an hour. And again, we've just got a call. They've hit another setback. They can't seem to fix the machine inside the tunnel. That means the odds of a rescue today are very slim. There are a lot of experts that have been brought in to consult on this rescue, including Harpal Singh. He's a project manager for a tunnel project in Jammu and Kashmir.
What could have been done to prevent this accident?
I'm not authorized to speak what should be done to avoid such kind of incident. Right now, our priority is to rescue the people.
The drilling, the augering, has stopped.
Arnold Dix is a tunneling expert brought in to help with the rescue.
The auger is broken. The machine is busted. It's irreparable.
And once again, officials here are back to exploring every available option. This is a rescue operation that's just been marred by technical difficulties. Families gathered here have gone from hope that the men will be out soon to now wondering how many more days they will remain trapped.
Samira Hussain. A novel about Ireland in the grip of a totalitarian state has won this year's prestigious Booker Prize. Prophet Song is the fifth book by the Irish writer Paul Lynch. Our culture editor Katie Razzle was at the awards ceremony in London.
The Booker judges said they were looking for a novel that didn't just transport them, but spoke to the troubling times we're in. In a week which saw riots on the streets of Dublin, Prophet Song feels just that. This dystopian novel begins with a chilling knock at the door of the home of a trade union official and depicts a family grappling with a terrifying new reality: secret police, disappearances and state-sponsored violence. Essia Dujan is this year's chair of the judges.
It's kind of a timely novel, given what's going on in the world right now, but it also had a kind of timeless quality to it, where we felt that this was a book that would endure.
Paul Lynch says the Syrian refugee crisis prompted him to write Prophet Song, which is also a reaction to the populism and nationalism of our age.
Katie Razzle. And staying on the subject of literature, an extremely rare copy of a book which was once owned by the English novelist Jane Austen and has her own underlinings has been unveiled and is going under the hammer at Sotheby's next month. So what does this book, Curiosities of Literature by Isaac Disraeli, tell us about Jane Austen's influences? My colleague Rebecca Casby has been speaking to Catherine Sutherland, Professor of Literature at the University of Oxford.
There were lots of volumes of Curiosities of Literature. This one, and certainly the marginal marks in this one, suggest that lots of the curiosities centre around comparative religion and superstition.
Yes, one of the sections that has been underlined is the fair sex having no souls. What does that mean?
That was an argument that went on through the 18th century, and an early feminist, a woman called Mary Astell, was arguing very strongly, of course, that women do have souls. Other sections that are underlined or have marginal lines are on the custom of saluting after sneezing. And there's a section that's underlined different habits of eating in different societies. I think to suggest that Jane Austen made those underlinings or linings is pretty tenuous, to be honest.
Nevertheless, I mean, it is more than 200 years since her death.
Yes.
Why is she even more popular than ever now?
She's accessible, and they're great romantic stories with her kind of feet on the ground. They seem within the realms of the possible.
I mean, a lot of people who haven't read the books, and many men I know that sort of poo-poo them as being romantic, they're not just about romance, though, are they? Because there is quite a bit of politics or social commentary going on in there as well.
Well, I think it's quite interesting that Virginia Woolf gave her copy of this book owned by Jane Austen to Maynard Keynes, the economist, because Jane Austen's romance is really very hard-headed. Her women always fall in love with the man with the big estate. And there's a reason for this. I mean, women had no real possessions of their own, no chance of earning a living, no chance of significant inheritance in their own right. If you didn't marry, you ended up in a life of extreme economic hardship. She understood that life for women had a price, and they had to get the best price they could for themselves during the time when they were considered to be romantically available, as it were.
She, of course, never did get married, did she?
But determined to make money, she did her best to make money through her writing.
So when we look at this period in history, so much of it has been written by men. So how important is her fiction to us understanding that period in British history?
She is very restricted in the society she looks at. She doesn't look at the upper classes. She doesn't look at the lower classes. She's not a Charles Dickens, but she does look at the lower gentry to which she belonged, which is, I suppose, now the upper middle classes. And she is very much aware of that world. And I think her description of that world is pretty realistic in social terms.
Professor Catherine Sutherland speaking to my colleague Rebecca Casby. Still to come in the Global News podcast.
For the people that has more money and can give more money, you can adopt an axolotl for 1 year or 6 months. But if you don't have enough financial support, you can buy a dinner for them.
A novel appeal to help save an endangered salamander, which could hold the key to medical breakthroughs. For more than 2 years, the coup leaders in Myanmar have been fighting off a variety of challenges. Organised opposition from ordinary Burmese to military rule, as well as long-term insurgencies by various ethnic groups. Now, an alliance of rebel groups in the north has taken control of another border crossing to China, following intense clashes with the military. Video released by a pro-rebel local media source shows the alliance group's flag being raised. Our Asia-Pacific editor Celia Hatton told Oliver Conway more about what's been happening at the border.
Well, this is a really important development in this, the Brotherhood Alliance, as they call themselves, their battle against the ruling military junta. Now, it's not just a loss of territory for the alliance's flag to be raised over this border crossing, but it has actually alarmed China. They're holding military exercises just on the other side of the border. But it's also a big financial loss for the junta itself, because a lot of trade crossed over that border crossing, $1.3 billion in trade in the first 6 months of this year. And the loss of that trading route is really serious for the junta. That's because they really need the foreign income and the taxes that they could get from that trade. Ever since the junta staged a coup almost 3 years ago, they've really been dependent on trade with China because so many Western countries have imposed sanctions. And so the loss of those key trading routes really is going to hit the junta hard.
Yeah, and how serious a military threat is this to the junta? Remind us of the various forces taking them on.
As you mentioned just a minute ago, for years, in some cases decades, ethnic rebel groups have been really battling the ruling government in Myanmar. The government has changed over the years, but those ethnic groups have been fighting for autonomy for quite some time. Now, what's new here is that those groups are increasingly forming alliances with each other, and they're coordinating their attacks. And really, the military simply just can't handle fighting on all these different fronts. So we have fighting along the northern border with China. We have increased fighting along the Thai border, the Indian border. Myanmar's military simply doesn't have the capacity to handle all of these different battles at once. And that's really what's changed. And that's really what's making even the government, the acting president of Myanmar, admitted just a few weeks ago that the country could split into parts. So it's not just being hit economically, but it's also being hit militarily.
And very briefly, is China beefing up security at that border?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are some who think that actually China sort of gave a tacit approval to this alliance because they don't think that the alliance could have banded together to gain so much territory from the junta without China's approval. But yes, many in China are worried because that border has always been very porous. In fact, some call it the Wild Wild East because there's always been a lot of crime and that border has always been a bit shaky and tenuous.
Celia Hatton. For a year and 9 months, Ukraine has been battling for its survival, trying to push back the Russian invaders who currently control about 18% of its territory. Overnight on Friday into Saturday, it faced its heaviest drone attack of the war. But now it's turning its attention to whether to hold a presidential election next year. President Volodymyr Zelensky said earlier this month that it's not the right time, but right-wing politicians in the US have indicated that funding could be cut off unless an election takes place in Ukraine. The BBC's Abdujalil Abdurasilov sent this report from Kyiv.
I'm in a metro station in central Kyiv. There is an air raid siren that just went off, and lots of people are now heading down into this station, which is used as a bomb shelter during air raid alerts. There are lots of kids with backpacks and mats sitting on the ground. This is just another reminder how difficult, how extremely difficult it will be for Ukraine to hold elections, simply because of safety issues.
More than 8 million Ukrainians are now refugees abroad, and about 1 million are serving on the front line defending the country. No election can be called fair if these people are not able to participate.
Я вважаю, що зараз вибори не на часі.
Earlier this month, President Zelensky, in a video address, tried to ease tensions by saying that it wasn't the right time to hold elections, and everyone should focus instead on defending the nation. But will this statement end the debate? Some observers say no, and one of the reasons is the US party politics.
The wave of this messaging that we need to organize elections was started by the group of American politicians, which targeted the budgeting process for Ukrainian financial aid and military aid.
Olga Ivazovska is the chairperson of the civil network Opora that monitors elections.
A total majority wants to continue support Ukraine. At the same time, it doesn't mean that far-right wing of this party will not use this topic against Ukraine next year during their presidential elections in the US.
And they're doing it already.
Ukraine is not a paragon of democracy.
This is Vivek Ramaswamy, one of the Republican candidates for presidential nomination.
It is threatened not to hold elections this year unless the US forks over more money. That is not democratic.
President Zelensky understands that he needs to address this growing rhetoric coming from the US, the main ally, whose military aid is vital for Ukraine to fight the war against Russia.
Розколоти підтримку Сполучених Штатів Америки може.
There are a few things that can split the US support of Ukraine, Mr. Zelensky said in an interview to Ukrainian TV last August. One of them is the elections, he said, and added that he had heard voices within the Republican Party against providing support to Ukraine. As Ukrainian MPs sing the national anthem in the parliament, they seem to agree that they cannot afford to plunge back into the old-time political standoff while they are fighting Russia. But the longer the war drags on, the harder it will be to maintain this consensus, partly because of domestic rivalry of Ukraine's Western partners.
Abdujalil Abdurasilov in Kyiv. Scientists in Mexico are asking people to help care for a critically endangered species of salamander known as the axolotl. Researchers say the creature's ability to regrow body parts may help in the study of tissue repair and even cancer treatment. Rachel Wright spoke to Professor Luis Zambrano, a biologist from the National University of Mexico.
The axolotl is an amphibian, it's a salamander, but it's a special kind of salamander. Normally salamanders are like lizards with bright colors, but this salamander particularly doesn't leave the water. They never transform from juveniles to adulthood. They have external gills, which looks like a crown over the head, and they have this eternal smile. So that is the axolotl.
But what's so amazing about them, though, is that they have the ability to regrow their own limbs. Tell me about that.
That's the reason a lot of labs around the world are using these salamanders. Axolotls are the animal that is by far the most studied animal in the labs in the world, because they can regrow any part of the body. The limbs, they can regrow the gills, and they can regrow even part of the brain if they lose part of the brain. So these animals are fantastic in terms of trying to study how are the mechanisms for try to regrow tissues in human beings.
But I understand that there used to be lots and now there's very few. Why is that?
The only place they live in the wild is in the south part of Mexico City. Mexico City used to be in a huge wetland. And the wetland is now reducing the 2% of the original coverage. And the water quality has been reduced. And that's the reason the axolotl changed the population. From 20 years ago, we have about 6,000 per kilometer squared. And now we only have less than 36 per kilometer squared. They are almost in the state.
So you're launching a campaign to help them. Tell me about your Adopt an Axolotl campaign.
We are looking for receiving financial support from all the world. For the people that has more money and can give more money, you can adopt an axolotl for 1 year or 6 months. But if you don't have enough financial support, you can buy a dinner for them.
What kind of food could you buy for them? What's their dinner consist of?
They normally feed on small fishes, for example, or small crayfishes, or even small worms. The idea is to use this money for have a very nice quality of life of these animals.
Professor Luis Zambrano from the National University of Mexico. The world of football has been paying tribute to the former England manager Terry Venables, who's died at the age of 80. He led England through one of its most fondly remembered periods, culminating in the Euro 96 campaign held in England, where his team lost to Germany on penalties in the semi-final. Our sports correspondent Nesta McGregor looks back at his time on and off the pitch.
Terry Venables dedicated almost 50 years to football. He made his debut for Chelsea as a teenager before going on to play for Tottenham and Queen's Park Rangers. But it was as a manager he truly blossomed. Venables is best known for the summer of 1996, when he was in charge of an England side vying for glory at the European Championships. Although the journey ended in semi-final heartache, losing to Germany on penalties, the team was credited with bringing the feel-good factor back to England fans. Speaking after the tournament, Venables said it was a career-defining moment.
Youngsters, of course, don't remember it too much, but their fathers have tell them all about it, sort of thing. But it is, they do come up and they say, that is the best feeling we've ever had. And it's just the shame of that, that it just wasn't to be.
Before England came calling, Terry Venables managed Queen's Park Rangers and Tottenham. He also gained respect across Europe, winning the Spanish League title during 3 years in charge of Barcelona. The former England captain, Gary Lineker, played for Terry Venables at Barcelona and at Tottenham.
It doesn't matter which player you speak to that's played for Terry, whether it was players probably, you know, way back at Crystal Palace or QPR or Barcelona, all of them would speak incredibly highly of them, not just as a coach, but also as a human being and a lovely, lovely, fun man.
Today, the current England manager, Gareth Southgate, also paid tribute to Venables, describing him as an outstanding coach, capable of handling the youngest player to the biggest star. Other players have also remembered the man who brought English football one of its most famous summers.
Nesta McGregor reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Darcy O'Brie, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.